to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and this is episode number 744. And as usual, I'm delighted to be back to talk about some important subjects. We've got a really exciting episode lined up today to talk about Kuyper and his lectures on Calvinism, the famous Stone Lectures at Princeton Theological Seminary. But to do that, let me introduce to you our panel. We have Daniel Ragusa, who serves as a pastor at Messiah URC out in New York. Welcome back, Dan. It's been a while. It's good to see you today.
Yeah, great to be here, Cam. Thanks for having me on, and really excited for this topic here.
Yeah, very much so. When we heard we were going to be speaking about this, I certainly wanted to have you on the program to offer your insights and also just to share the joy of speaking with our guest. I'm very, very excited and pleased to introduce to you, to everyone, who should know the name already if you don't know the face or the voice, Dr. George Haring, who serves as the director of the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute at the Theological University of Kampen, as well as professor of history at the Free University in Amsterdam. Welcome, Dr. Haring. It's such a pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to join this, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thanks for doing this. And we know that there's a bit of a stretch here with the time zone. So thank you also for taking time out of your evening to join us, even in an afternoon. We don't take that for granted. But today we're going to be speaking about a chapter in a new book that Dr. Haring has written. The book's title is Calvinism for a Secular Age, a 21st Century Reading of Abraham Kuyper's Stone Lectures. And it's edited by Jessica R. Ustra and Robert J. Ustra. It's published by IVP Academic. And the chapter that we're speaking about is titled Lost in Translation, the First Text of the Stone Lectures. This is a copy, at least my copy of the book. I've been trying to dig up a copy in Dutch. I found a few used copies. I'm going to look for them, but haven't yet been able to locate the three missing original bound copies that are no longer extant. But if anyone has one, you can mail it to me. we'll talk about that a little bit later, what those are and what that might tell us about the original text of Kuyper's lectures and the English translation therein. But if you don't have a copy of this book, or at least a version of it, whether it's this binding or not, please, people need to get a copy. Even Google Books has a free scanned version of an older edition of Kuyper's Stone Lectures. You can download through Google Books. Whatever the case may be, get a copy and read, because it's an important volume, and certainly historically speaking, I think it's just a critical read to talk about Dutch Calvinism, but Calvinism internationally, not just Dutch Calvinism, but Calvinism as it applies to the 20th century. Significant work. So get a copy of that. But there's a lot more to be said than just what that text contains. There's a whole rich history of how the text came about, and that's what we're going to be speaking about today. First, I just want to mention a few bits of news and just updates and reminders. Please visit our website at reformedforum.org, not only for other episodes like this, where you can download resources and courses and conversations on a whole host of theological topics, but there are ways to get in touch with us as well. So if you have any comments or questions, you can send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org and take a look at our upcoming events. We're going to soon be having some cohorts starting on Van Til's Doctrines of Revelation, his Doctrine of General and Special Revelation. That's starting soon for those people interested in that. But then down the road, we have some lectures and cohorts that will be starting eventually on Common Grace, and then some other courses on site in our new studio in Libertyville, Illinois, that we'll be posting online soon. So I want to remind people of that there are opportunities to connect and to interact with other like-minded Reformed theologians and aspiring church workers. So we're excited about that and looking forward to ways of connecting with you. Well, let's get down to our main topic today then, speaking about the Stone Lectures. Dr. Haring, I'd like to ask you just a few personal questions in the background of this subject. When were you first introduced to Abraham Kuyper, but even more specifically, these particular lectures? How did you encounter them for the very first time?
I think the first time I learned about Abraham Kuyper was in my secondary school. That was a Christian. It was a Reformed secondary school. and my history teacher told about Abraham Kuyper. But I think I first learned about the stone lectures, I think, during my student days at Leiden University. So when I was 20, 21, 22.
Did they seem unusual to you, or was it foreign? Did it feel like he was speaking to your heart? How did you encounter them? What did you think of them at first?
Well, I've been raised as a Reformed boy. I grew up in the Reformed Churches Liberated, Gereformeerde Kerk Vrijgemaakt, we say in Dutch.
Yeah,
that's the church of, let's say, Schilder, Klaus Schilder. So I was well first into the Reformed tradition, also in catechism class, etc. So his name was mentioned there. So I wasn't really surprised when I read the stone lectures for the first time, not in the sense of, oh, I've never heard this before. But I was struck, of course, by the coherence of his lectures. I also admired his openness to culture, his systematic approach of what is the function and the place of the church, what is the function and place of the state, what does art mean in our lives, etc. So I think after having read this, not for the first time, but having read this time and again, I think I may call myself a Kuyperian. So I really enjoy his ideas. And the interesting thing about Abraham Kuyper, in the Netherlands at least, is that, of course, there are many theologians and philosophers who have ideas. But the interesting thing about Abraham Kuyper is he made them work.
Yeah.
So he founded the university, he founded a newspaper, he founded a political party. And, well, he changed the political phase of the Netherlands. I would not say on his own, but without him, it would not have been possible to change our country in the way he did.
How would you say that the Netherlands even today remembers Abraham Kuyper? Is his name on? Is there more of a legacy than just his name being on buildings or being remembered as the founder of certain things or the prime minister? Is there any enduring intellectual tradition that he established, or some fondness that just people in the secular square might have for him?
Yes, well, streets are named after him, of course, because he has been a prime minister of the Netherlands. There is a statue in the place where he was born, in Maassluis. There are institutions which are still named after him. Well, there are also many people. So the point with the name of Kuyper is, when you name it in the Netherlands, you're either for or against. Yes. Everyone immediately knows, I like, oh, that's the guy I like. Oh, that's the guy I hate. So people still know what kind of ideas he had, and especially since the Netherlands have become more secularized than at the beginning of the 20th century, people overall are critical of him. So there is not a strong Kuyperian tradition, but still there are two political parties in parliament, two Christian parties who often refer to him and who pretend that they follow his ideas and that they try to apply them in the present situation. There is, of course, the tradition of Christian philosophy of Herman Dooyeweerd and Vollenhoven. Well, they also stand in the tradition of Kuyper, and still at several universities in the Netherlands, there are special professors in Christian philosophy.
Oh, interesting.
Who teach his ideas and also Dooyeweerd's ideas.
I'd like to ask, a whole host of questions. We could ask you questions for weeks, but focusing in on the stone lectures, some people might not be familiar with what these are in terms of a running series of lectures at Princeton Theological Seminary. Could you provide us a bit of historical background, just context, so that we understand how Kuyper eventually was invited? What time period are we looking at, and how did these lectures come about in the first place?
Well, Princeton Seminary was founded in 1812, and in the 1870s, there was a donor who said, well, I will donate money. His name was Stone, L.P. Stone, And he said, I will donate money if you organize a lecture on the Reformed Presbyterian tradition on an annual basis. You invite someone, you invite him to give 5, 6, or 7 lectures, and we do that every year. And that started in the 1870s, and it's still going on. There are still annual Stone lecture series at Princeton Theological Seminary. So Abraham Kuyper was invited in the mid-1890s by Princeton Theological Seminary. And, the man behind this idea was Gerhardus Voss, who had become a professor in Princeton in 1893. Gerhardus Voss was from the Netherlands, as you know, and he studied at what's now called Calvin Theological Seminary. And then he went to Princeton, and then he went back to Europe to earn his PhD in Strasbourg. And when he was working there in Strasbourg, that is around 1886, so he was about 24 years old at that time, Abraham Kuyper learned to know him and offered him a professorship at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam, a professorship in the Old Testament. And Gerhardus Voss, who was befriended with Herman Bavinck, talked this over with Herman. And, well, Gerhardus said, yes, I'd like to have that job. Then his parents, who lived in Grand Rapids at that time, said, no, Gerhardus, we want you as a professor in our small seminary. You have to build up that seminary. So I won't allow you to become a professor at Kuyper's Free University. So then he said, sorry, thank you for the offer. And yes, I accepted the offer, but my parents say I have to come back to go back home and become a professor at Calvin. So he did. And he was a bit disappointed at first, but and he had the opportunity to develop himself, especially when he went, of course, to Princeton as a real academic theologian. Well, he still reminded his days with Bavinck and Kuyper, and he still appreciated their ideas very much. And he thought, well, they should be introduced to the United States. And I will talk this over with Benjamin Warfield, who was, the primus inter pares at Princeton Theological Seminary. And Warfield, who was very well informed about the Reformed community worldwide, said, oh yes, I know that name. So let's do that, Gerhardus. So you write him a letter and invite him to come over and give the Stone lectures in 1896. Kuyper got that letter, but he had to turn that down, this invitation, because he was involved in all kinds of trouble in his Reformed churches. And he said, well, I cannot leave now. Maybe next year. But next year, there were elections for the parliament. And I cannot come because I have to lead the campaign. And then he promised, well, in 1898, I will come. And that was interesting that he did go then, because in that year, in September 1898, Queen Wilhelmina was enthroned, and he was now the first member of the parliament. So he should be there. There were only two people not present at the enthronement. That was Abraham Kuyper, and that was a socialist who was against the House of Orange. So he didn't come, and Kuyper didn't come. Well, and it was seen in the Netherlands as an offense. But he was on his boat to fulfill his promise, which had been delayed for 2 years already. So he was on his boat on the way to New York and to Princeton to deliver the lectures. So even his wife said, because he sent a telegram to Wilhelmina to congratulate her. The telegram was in the newspaper, of course. But even his wife said, Abram, I don't think it was very wise to leave at this time.
Yeah.
But he went. So in 1898, in October 1898, he landed in Princeton, and he gave there those 6 Stone lectures on Calvinism.
That's fascinating.
I know we want to speak mostly about Abraham Kuyper and these stone lectures here, but there's also a great interest of mine, and I know for a number of people that listen to this this podcast here, on Gerhardus Voss.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's clearly a huge influence that you hear in Voss's, I guess, his inaugural address at the theological school in Grand Rapids, with the Kuyperian influence, his address, The Prospects of American Theology. Kind of a question is that, you know, early on when Voss is teaching there, you do hear that Kuyperian influence, but it seems to be not as explicit as Voss's career goes on, though certainly there, not to say that it disappeared or he changed his views, but any thoughts and maybe some explanations as to why, you know, Voss is very explicitly, in a sense, Kuyperian, and then, it kind of dulls out in more explicit tones in his writings.
Yeah, well, indeed, I think you could call him a neo-Calvinist, and I count him to the neo-Calvinist tradition. Of course, you might also count him to the Presbyterian tradition, but I, from my point of view, count him to the neo-Calvinist tradition.
Sure,
I do too.
And he was, of course, in close touch with both Abraham Kuyper and Herman Bavinck, especially in the 1890s and 1900s. But, it seemed to have disappeared, but I don't think it did. So I'm writing a book on the Dutch, on the American connection of the Vrije Universiteit. And I found in archives all kinds of letters, also from the 1910s, when he advises Herman Bavinck about American students who come to Amsterdam to study. So he is still involved in that, and he's still in touch with especially with Herman Bavinck. And students from Calvin often went to Princeton to get an advice from Gerhardus Voss, either to study at Princeton or at the Vrije Universiteit, and several went to the Vrije Universiteit. I agree that in his later publications, he doesn't mention often the names of Bavinck and Kuyper anymore. But I think that also his biblical theology, which is one of the feats, let's say, of Voss's theology, has strongly been influenced by the stress on history in the Calvinist tradition. And if you compare him to books that have been written in the 1920s and 30s on, let's say, on the history of the covenant, in Dutch, and you compare this with what Gerhardus Voss wrote, you see all kinds of similarities.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you.
That is. Speaking, you know, more about Kuyper and Voss, that connection, we definitely see then how Kuyper came to Princeton, being invited to come deliver these stone lectures. For many people, myself included, we haven't thought much more about that other than actually what I have in an English translation of this. But to think about how that text came about is intriguing. And that's the subject of this particular chapter, Lost in Translation. The story of that, the history of it, what is the text? How did it begin? And how did it come to the form that was delivered and then the form that we might have now in a printed copy? To get to some of those interesting points, I'd love to ask just more generally, did Kuyper, was he very fluent in English? Did he read and write and speak English well, whether other people thought so or even Kuyper himself? How did he perceive his language abilities?
Well, he could read French, German, English. That was no problem for an academic in the 19th century. But when he was invited, he realized, of course, that he was not very used to speak it very well. So, of course, he had been to London. He had been to England many times because he liked that country. But when he got his invitation, he thought, well, I have to practice my English. I have to practice my English. So he found someone, a British lady, to come over to his Amsterdam house and to live with his family for 4 or 5 months. And they agreed that when they were at table, they would speak English only. So no Dutch, no Dutch was allowed. So the whole family practiced their English, Kuiper did so as well. So and Kuiper, so he practiced his English a lot in the months before he went to the United States, but also of course he had to write his lectures in English. So what he first did was write them in Dutch, send them to friends in the United States, among them Gerhardus Vos, and asked them to translate it. So Gerhardus Vos translated a lot of texts for Kuiper and for Bavinck, and also one of the lectures, and the other lectures were translated by others. And then they were sent back to Kuiper, and he started reading them, and he said, no, this is not my English. This is not fluent enough. This is not how I want to express myself. So then he said to this lady, Mrs. Ashton, he said, well, can you help me? And let me go every day, 1 or 2 hours, through those lectures and discuss every sentence and maybe make it a little bit more fluid, make it a little bit more literary, etc. So they did together close reading and they amended the texts. And then finally he said, well, I'm satisfied now. And I have this text printed in 10 or 12 copies. And I take them with me to the United States. And he left in August, and 1 or 2 days before he left, the books, the 10 books, were ready. And then he gave one as a present, of course, to Mrs. Ashton.
Mm-hmm.
he left some at home and some he took with him on the boat to the United States. So that's the original text that he took with him on the boat. And first he went to the Adirondacks. That's how you pronounce it?
Sure.
The mountains.
Sure.
Yeah. So he first went to the Adirondacks, and because he loved hiking, and he hiked for 2 weeks in those mountains, and he trained on those stacks in his hotel room. He made them a little bit shorter, and then he was ready to go to Princeton. And then he arrived in Princeton to give his lectures. But the interesting thing is that's the story I was able to reconstruct
from
correspondence, etc. And then there is a copy of Kuiper's Stone Lectures in the library of Princeton Theological Seminary.
Yes,
that was the copy, Benjamin Warfield got. And in it, he wrote on the front page a story about the translation of those texts. And that's a very interesting story. He says, well, while Kuiper was in the Adirondacks, he sent us the Dutch text and asked us, me, to translate these. And Warfield thought, oh, how can I do this in 10 days? So he sent them to friends in the United States and asked them to translate this text as soon as possible, because within 10 days, the text had to be delivered. So he sent them to people in Iowa, but also Gerhardus Vos, Warfield says, translated one, and, well, several others. And then Kuiper came and gave his lectures from this translation that Warfield had organized. But the interesting thing is that all the letters and all the information I found on the Stone Lectures and on how the text came into being are not compatible with what B.B. Warfield wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So I first told you the story of Kuiper sending texts to his friends, and so I can prove that from letters in his archives. So by May, June 1898, he was done with that correspondence. He had received all the text, and he made with Mrs. Ashton the definite English text. And now Warfield has a story. He sent us not an English text, but a Dutch text. And he asked us to translate it. So it seems, if you read Warfield's story, there are two translations. Mm-hmm. One translation Kuiper organized himself, and one translation he ordered. He asked Warfield to organize that. So And yeah, well, the interesting thing is that Voorfield wrote this comment in the published edition, the official published edition of the Stone Letters, which was published in 1899, so the year after. And so when Kuiper came to New York, he made a contract with an American publishing house, and they said, okay, we will publish it in 1899. And the same happened in the Netherlands. It also was published in the Netherlands in Dutch, but also in 1899, in the spring. So Voorfield wrote it in that volume and not in one of the 10 copies that are still there. I can show you one copy, by the way.
Yes, you have one of the 10.
Wait a second. Wait
sure.
A second. So this is one of the 10 copies.
Oh, my.
This is one of the 10 copies. And if you open it, you can see it's a blank page and it's a printed page.
Yes.
And it's a very large letter, so you can easily read it. Short lines. So of this book, there are about 6 or 7 copies still extant. 3 or 4 are in the special collections of Princeton Theological Library. One is with me, one is in the Vrije Universiteit Library, and there's another minister in the Netherlands who has one. But that's about it. But this text, I think, and I think I can prove that from the sources, this is the text Kuiper used, and this is the text Kuiper read.
Yes.
But Voorfield has a different story, which is very interesting, because most of the times, if someone has such a story, you can connect it to other archival information, like letters, diaries, etc. But all the information that I found refers to this copy and not to the story that Voorfield told. So that's a complexity, and it's very hard to explain, because, well, if Voorfield would not have been a very precise person, but he was always very exact in what he wrote. So I cannot explain it.
Yeah.
You also might say maybe he wrote it in 1920. When he was about to die, and when his thoughts were confused or something like that. But there's no hint that Voorfield was confused in 1920. He still worked on. He died more or less suddenly. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to explain.
Well, this is what's so fascinating about your chapter, is that all of this unfolds. It is very intriguing. I mean, it reads, you know, like a little bit like a mystery novel. Like, you want to know the next piece. And I love how you organize the material. So what we're getting now and what we've just listened to is a brilliant and wonderful synopsis of this. But to unfold with the mystery is really quite interesting. So just to recap or come at this from another angle, the historiography of the Stone Lectures original text has largely been based on Voorfield's comment, correct? Like the prevailing understanding has all been based on what Voorfield said, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and given the other historical evidence, that just doesn't fit.
No. And the interesting thing is, I can understand very well why people based their explanation of the text on Voorfield's note, because that's a very clear note. And Voorfield is an authority.
Of course.
So the information I collected was, of course, here is a small piece, and here I found a small piece. So it took years of research and finding something at Calvin Seminary, finding something in Princeton Library, finding something in the archives in Amsterdam, etc. And then pulling that together, then I said, well, here are two different stories.
Right. Yeah. One thing you do, just for the listeners and viewers to know, is that you do explore how to harmonize these two accounts. So you explore all the options, like what would it take for Voorfield to be correct and for the rest of this historical evidence to hold and substantiate. And really, at the end of the day, it would be just impossible, right? I mean, it would have had to been two copies, two translations that Kuiper was working with almost simultaneously. It just, and there's no evidence of anything of that nature.
No, no. It's also interesting that the copy Warfield is, or the text Warfield is referring to has never been found.
Yes, there.
We don't have that text.
No. The text that we do have in terms of more modern printings of the lectures, they agree and are the same as the one you have there with the red binding?
Well, that's another difficulty. Kuiper thought when he returned to the Netherlands and he made his text ready for print, he changed here and there something, because of course he got some reactions to his lectures. Someone said, "You are mistaken, it was not that person, it was that person," or you shouldn't use the word Weltanschauung, the German word for worldview. So he changed some little things, and Warfield writes in his note in this 1899 copy that Kuiper, by reworking his text for this printed version, made the text worse. So he amended the text, but that was not good for the English. And that's also a remark I think Henry Bates made. Henry Bates was a minister in the Christian Reformed Churches, church, and he edited a volume of the Stone Lectures in 1931. So that's about 30, 35 years later. And the Stone Lectures had not been very popular. So, but now he made a new edition and he said, well, the English is a little bit poor. The interesting thing is Peter Haslam, who wrote a book on the Stone Lectures.
Yes, Erdmann's published it.
Creating a Christian Worldview, a famous book. He says, well, The English in of Kuiper's Stone Lectures is good and is coherent. So he is very positive about the English language, Kuiper wrote in. So and then he talks about the 1899 edition. He was very positive about it. But Henry Bates was critical.
I'm thinking through, you know, what the significance of these two different reconstructions are in terms of, you know, I think part of your thesis in arguing for the international significance or the scope of Calvinism as Kuiper thought through it, in terms of the one being more of a hasty English translation and the other one being more of a well thought through, a lot of effort went into it from Calvin as you're arguing, from Kuiper as you're arguing. So, you know, what does your reconstruction in terms of Kuiper's, great effort and work that got put into it say to his desire for an international influence of Calvinism?
Well, several things. In the first place, Kuiper had been working on other translations as well, also in the years before 1898. And it struck me how close he looked at the translations, how important it was for him to have the books from the Dutch translated into English very well. And he had difficulty in finding the right translators. But it was very important to him that his books would be published in really good English, because indeed he wanted to introduce Calvinism to America, or to introduce, maybe, I think in his opinion, it was reintroduce Calvinism to America. So he was very keen on having a very exact and good translation. That's one part of the story. So it convinced me that he thought it was very important to have a good introduction in the Anglophone world. And from a historical point of view, it was important for me to correct the picture that Kuiper more or less made it very difficult for Warfield, because he only sent it in 10 days before. And then he ordered that translation. Quick, you have to do this for me. And this is part of the image that people have in the Netherlands about Abraham Kuyper. He was a very difficult man. He was very autocratic. Everyone had to listen to him, and he didn't mind if he brought people into big difficulties, if only would happen what he would be done. That would be done. So, but here you see that's not the case. Kuyper, in my opinion, never asked Warfield to do this, and Kuyper himself took care for the translation. So he wasn't the difficult guy that people like to see him like. So he prepared himself very well. He didn't rely on other people. He just made his own text, and he came completely trained and ready to give the lectures. So for me, it is important to stress that aspect, because the fact that he did this strange request to Warfield is used in historiography to show that Kuyper was a difficult man. Maybe I don't deny he was a difficult man, but anyway, you cannot prove it with this.
Sure. Are there any extant letters of Kuyper to Warfield in this time frame that either might shed some light on how Warfield's thoughts might have been clouded a little bit?
No. So there are letters in the years before when they are trying to set the right date for the lectures, etc. But the letters most of the times are by Gerhardus Vos.
Yeah.
And Warfield now and then wrote to Kuyper, and Kuyper wrote back. For example, in 1912, when Princeton had the centennial celebration, Warfield invited Kuyper and Bavinck to come over and to share in the celebration in one way or another. Well, they were obliged to refuse, as they said. And later on, the daughter of Abraham Kuyper translated lectures by Warfield on Calvin into Dutch. So there was still a relationship. There were no problems between them.
No. Sure. This is completely speculation based on nothing other than the fact that Warfield is a, as you have even said, usually a precise person, is not mistaken. Is it at all conceivable just some haphazard assistant just mailed Warfield some of these Dutch copies because they thought they needed them for some administrative reason, and that Warfield just gets these in the mail with no letter, has no idea why he has them, and then tries to move heaven and earth to translate them into English?
Well, it's possible.
But lots of things are possible.
No, but that's of course not what Kuyper said.
Right.
What Warfield said.
I jest.
About 10 days before the lectures were to begin, Dr. Kuyper sent his Dutch manuscript and asked
that
he translated for his use.
Yes.
So again, here he's very precise in the detail.
Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have been mistaken. I mean that he wouldn't have misunderstood why he received those if things happened that way.
Doesn't Warfield list Gerhardus Vos as the one who he asked to translate the sixth lecture? Is there any evidence from Vos that he did translate that sixth lecture?
No. Mm-hmm. If you look at the lectures, I know that Steffens translated the lecture, and he translated the fourth lecture. Steffens was a professor at the Reformed Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan, of the Reformed Church in America. He was a professor there, and he knew Dutch. He came from the northern part of the Netherlands, just across the German border, and he spoke Dutch. And the son of Abraham Kuyper had lived with Steffen, so they knew each other quite well. And he sent in his text in June. But I don't have letters of the other translators. So I just have a letter from Steffens, and Steffens explains how we worked. And it's clear from how what he tells, what he did, he has been working on this for weeks to get it very well translated. So when Warfield asked to do this within 5 or 6 days,
this
must have been impossible.
Right, just doesn't fit. Mm. Oh, that's fascinating. People need to read the whole chapter to understand all the ins and outs, and it's all fully documented with footnotes, dates. I mean, this is all a reproducible case, as all good scholarship ought to be, especially the historical variety. But zooming out a little bit beyond, unless Dan might have some further questions or if you'd like to add more on this specific historical details, I'd like to ask you about the stone lectures more generally. And I know it's the scope of this whole book, of which this is one chapter. But the book, again, Calvinism for a Secular Age, a 21st century reading of Abraham Kuyper's stone lectures. Dr. Harink, what would be your hope for this current generation in encountering Kuyper's stone lectures? How would you hope that they would engage them, receive them? What are some ways that you think the stone lectures might be helpful to the present church in our present historical context?
Okay. I think the title of the book is very interesting. So it's Calvinism for a Secular Age. Mm-hmm. And when people talk about the Secular Age, they think the Secular Age has started in the 1960s, 70s, or maybe after the Second World War. But as a matter of fact, Kuyper in his days realized that the secularization had started. And since the days of the French Revolution, something really important had changed in European culture. And that was just before 1789, to put it in a scheme, people just thought in terms of Christianity. God has created this world. God rules this world through the church and through kings, etc. And there was no really doubt about that among the common folk. Of course, there were intellectual people who challenged ideas. But after the French Revolution, it became common in Europe to think, okay, you can think in the Christian way, or you can think in the, let's say, liberal, that's what they said in the 19th century, or secular way. And Kuyper's stone lectures are based on the idea, well, this is the struggle in our culture. Will it be Christianity or will it be liberalism? Will it be God on the throne or will it be man on the throne? That was simply said, the debate. And he said, this is a struggle, and not just a struggle for fun. It's about life and death. Mm. So if our European culture will survive and will have influence in the world, then it has to be Christian. It has to be Christian. And Christ calls us to reform culture. We are not just Christians on Sunday. We are not just Christians in the church. Mm-hmm. But God calls us to reform culture. So we have to go out and try to change it. So this challenge of liberalism is not something that passes our door and we are not influenced by it. No, it's everywhere, and it also creeps into the church. We get a liberal theology in which the miracles are denied, etc. So there is really something going on here. And from his student days on, Kuyper realized this. In his student days, he was educated at Leiden University, which was at that time the seat of modern theology. So when his professor taught in classroom that Christ had not risen from the dead because there were no proofs, then all the students, including Abraham Kuyper, stood up and they applauded. This was great that the professor dared to say this and dared to distance himself from historic Christianity. This was really something, let's say, revolutionary. People who studied at other universities came to Leiden, especially to hear this. This was new. There was a student, a co-student of Abraham Kuyper, who wrote to his parents, this is great what happens over here. These professors, they really are interesting. They are more than Paul. Mm-hmm. And so this is a new gospel. So, well, in that climate, Kuyper was raised as a theologian. And only when he came to the first village where he became a pastor, he met people who said, well, we don't talk to you because you are a modern theologian. And, well, you know, most theologians would just turn and said, well, you're very impolite. I will never talk with you anymore. But Kuyper was interested. He thought, what? You won't talk with me? I knock on your door again. and he came back. And in the end, this was a young lady. She said, well, you can come to our meetings on Wednesday evening because we don't go to church, but we have our own meetings. And then Kuiper came to the meeting and he was a Calvin scholar. So he had studied Calvin and his dissertation was on Calvin. Mm. But there he found out that those simple farmers, bakers, millers, what were they reading in their meetings on Wednesday night? Calvin's Institution. Mm. He didn't understand it. This is a very academic text. You even don't pronounce your Dutch very well. And you read Calvin. He couldn't understand it. He had never realized that you could read Calvin and believe what he said, share his opinions. That was a historical text and no more than that. And of course, that had to be reformed and made better for the new age we are living in. And suddenly he realized those people, they read Calvin because they believe this. And Calvin speaks to their heart. And by, he changed. And he started to read Calvin in the same way. So he was convinced by the common folk, not by his professors, by the common folk, that Calvinism was the way you should understand the gospel. And that was the way you should live as a Christian. So then, only then he became a Calvinist. Well, wow. That's the message in his stone lectures.
Sure. And those stone lectures are highly influential. And again, I think critical reading for any of our listeners, if you haven't read them already, and I'm still working through them again, just having picked them up in response to reading this particular chapter. But I love that story. I had a similar occasion when I was taking an external course at the Catholic University of America with a bunch of progressive modern Roman Catholics. And they were asking me as a Reformed person, they thought I was like, they go, Reformed, like Karl Barth, right? And I said, well, no, I don't really care too much for Barth. They go, well, what are some other theologians you know? And I would start listing, well, you don't know Warfield or Voss or anything. They go, no, I've never heard of those guys. You go, John Calvin? They said, oh, yeah, we know, we've heard of John Calvin. And I said, yeah, that's my guy then for you. And I actually believe it. And they're like, they couldn't grasp the fact that I might actually believe the things in this 500-year-old book, but such is life. And I'm glad to hear that story about Kuiper, and I'm glad that was influential on him. And we praise the Lord for his work. It's been very significant in a lot of the lives of a lot of our people, and mine as well. So this has been fascinating. I'd love to speak with you all day. Perhaps we can have you back sometime to talk more about some other topics. Your CV precedes you, and I'll have links to many of your books and articles and publications online for people to check out. A lot more work, scholarly work, even on the relationship between Voss and Kuiper. And our own Danny Olinger, he wrote a biography on Gerhardus Voss that we published here at Reformed Forum. And he just told me as recently as yesterday that he is, you know, forever indebted and grateful to your scholarship, because so much of his work on Voss's biography depended on the work that you did, academically speaking. So thank you for joining us, and thank you for that, and keep it up. We very much appreciate all of your efforts.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me. Thank you, and God bless you.
Well, it's our pleasure. Certainly we would like for everyone else to follow up online. We'll have links to everything available in our episode description. All of this will be available at reformedforum.org. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, we have a contact form there, but a simpler and perhaps even more direct way would be just to send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org, or of course you can get us on Twitter @reformedforum. But I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.